the eviction moratorium ending, Indiana sitting on CARES Act money, plus a former lieutenant governor on why Governor Holcomb won't expand vote by mail, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 7th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Holcomb administration announced Indiana will launch a settlement arbitration tool for landlords and renters as it braces for a flood of evictions when the state's eviction moratorium ends in 10 days.
The governor's general counsel, Joe Herons, says the goal of the arbitration program, which will be free of charge to renters and landlords, is to settle eviction lawsuits and prevent massive backlogs in the courts.
This can be an effective and, frankly, less onerous way to resolve disputes, and it is oftentimes has the added benefit of preserving the existing relationship between the two parties.
More than 24,000 Hoosiers have already applied for rental assistance through a $25 million state program. The Holcomb administration announced Wednesday it will add $15 million more to that program. But that assistance is not meant to provide enough money to cover a single month's rent, and the state urges people to talk with their landlords and work out a payment plan.
Is this really the answer for Hoosiers struggling with their rent? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is Indiana really doing enough for rental assistance?
It clearly is not. I mean, you can talk all you want. If you don't have the money to make the payment, where's the discussion going? The governor should have extended the moratorium on evictions much longer than 2 weeks. I said that last week. I believe that. Having said that, I don't think it's a bad idea to have some kind of mediation or arbitration for renters in general. We're lagging behind the renters' rights of other states, and we have a record high evictions in this state. And part of the reason is that we don't protect renters. So if this is a first step towards putting in place some of those things, that's a good thing. I don't think it's going to help the people who are unemployed with COVID when Mitch McConnell can't even decide to give them any additional funds.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is quibbling with the idea of this settlement arbitration. I mean, the Chief Justice has talked about her concerns about the backlog in the courts with evictions and how many renters are unrepresented in court that she sees on a daily basis. So I don't think anybody has a problem with that. I think it's the flip side of it, is this seems to be all we're doing. Is it enough?
Well, I mean, the alternative is you just go and buy everyone's rents out, and you're trying to figure out, it's like everything else we're doing here with the CARE Act dollars and what companies are getting money and which aren't, who needs it the most, and can we identify those people, put money into the system to help them, and also do this arbitration. So they're trying to bring cash assistance and this conversation about solving this problem or coming up with a plan to work your way back to an on-time rent schedule. The other part of this, and I know that we are not, clearly last session we were not friendly to tenants with the tenants' rights bill, and the governor vetoed that bill. Obviously, in the context as COVID was emerging and the economy was starting to tank, it was becoming a real problem. So there's clearly more work that needs to be done there. I think the governor recognized that in the veto of that legislation and the assistance that he's gotten here. He's extended this 2 more weeks, but 2 weeks is kind of a lifetime in this. When you're turning the dials on assistance and federal dollars and what Congress is doing, you're doing that on almost a semi-daily basis. They're looking at this every other day on what's available, what resources are available to the state, what federal money can they use. And so 2 weeks is a long time, and the governor's proven that he'll revisit this based on what's happening in real life.
But he's sitting on $1.2 billion.
They don't know how to spend.
We're gonna talk about that in more detail in a second. But on the idea of this eviction moratorium, so the same day, almost the same breath that Holcomb said, I extended the eviction moratorium until next Friday, August 14th, and that's going to be it. He then said, "What we're offering this settlement arbitration tool," essentially acknowledging, "Oh yeah, we are worried about a huge flood of evictions." Is that okay?
In the end, it won't be sufficient because clearly you have a lot of Hoosiers who are on the brink of losing their dwellings. Rental properties or those who have mortgages, and more will have to be done. I think the question here is, where will the action originate? I think there are many in this state who are banking on the federal government sort of sweeping in here at some point. Now, Congress seems unable at this point. You know, talks have all but collapsed as we prepare to tape this. However, the White House, again, just today, made clear that it has prepared and drafted a series of executive orders. Apparently, Congress is sort of irrelevant these days in this era of executive power. But one of them specifically would be an eviction moratorium or an extension of that. So it may be that this is rendered a moot point.
But would you want to be counting on the White House and Congress for anything right now?
Well, no. I mean, but they're not in a good position. I mean, the fact is that some people are going to get evicted. I don't know that there's physically a way for us to make sure that no one is impacted. That would take enormous amount
of
money.
I think what we're worried about, though, is so that the state programs, where they got a little more than 24,000 applications. Now, Indianapolis has Marion County has a separate program, so that's another, I don't remember what the number is, but that's another significant number. But you have housing groups across the state who are saying it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 200,000 people who need assistance. And we're not talking about even paying their rents. We're talking about that's hundreds, more than 100,000 people who just nothing.
Yeah.
That's where we are.
Yeah.
Speaking of a subject that I just teased a moment ago, Indiana says it has spent or committed to spending less than $1 billion in federal CARES Act money out of the $2.4 billion it's received.
Office of Management and Budget Director Chris Johnston says one reason so much CARES Act money is unspent is inconsistent messages from the federal government.
We didn't want to make a big transfer before the end of our fiscal year and then have differing guidance come out from the federal government that said, no, you can't, you know, use the money this way.
Johnston says the state has also tried to spend some of the money on, for instance, testing supplies, but those dollars have gone unused amid nationwide shortages. The state is also holding back in the hopes the federal government will allow Indiana to use CARES dollars to fill massive holes in its budget. But Democratic legislators argue the state should spend more money now on relief programs for struggling Hoosiers, particularly as extra federal unemployment benefits expire.
Mike O'Brien, is the state justified in waiting on so much of this money?
I think so. I mean, because this money is at some point going to stop coming. And so they need to figure out, one, it's never been clear for months now exactly what you can spend this money on outside of direct assistance on things that are specifically COVID-related, not things that are impacted as a consequence of COVID in other parts of state government that also provide critical services. Where they've had to augment budgets and cut budgets by at least 15%. So I think they're trying to be conservative. It's clear that Congress can't be counted on. It's $1 trillion or $3 trillion, and they met all week on it. You don't know what's coming next. And the state's got to be judicious, isn't it? If you start spending money, if you sustain the enhanced unemployment benefit using these dollars, even if you could do that, well, what if Congress comes back in 3 days and extends it? Well, now you've spent that money that you're never going to get back that you could have used on something else. And so they're trying to figure out what the rules are around this $1.4 billion, not knowing what's coming next,
This crisis is not over. It's not going to be over next week or next month.
Mm-mm.
So in light of that, because for all we know, this is all the money we might have for a long time, do you have to wait at least a little longer before you start spending it?
I don't know. I mean, you've got people losing their dwellings. You've got people that are hungry. You've got people that need testing. You've got needs that are real right now, and we know they're there. And what we're saying is we're not willing to spend money we were given for that purpose because we want to see if we could use it in a better way, maybe to build the surplus back up again or some other silly thing that they want to do. This is a crisis, and the money was provided to help the people that are hurting the most, and we're not helping them.
I don't think they're trying to build back up the
surplus.
They're trying to go broke, because that's the most important function of state government.
On the politics of this, the reasons that Chris Johnston talked about, what Mike just mentioned too, this idea that there's so much uncertainty, we don't know, both with the money we already have and maybe some money that might come in the future. But politically speaking, isn't the other side of it, which is you're sitting on $1.4 billion, a lot easier to digest?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look great. You know, this money was given to help people, and other states have added to their state unemployment. You know, for instance, ours is maxed at $390 a week. We could add to that. Other states have provided sick leave for people, have increased hazard pay for certain workers. So there are a lot of states who are helping people. We seem to just be putting it into like a few, like a training program here or there, or a little bit of rental assistance. But sitting with $1.4 billion when there's so much need out there is a hard thing.
$40 million in the rental assistance program is helping 24,000 people get at most $2,000 over a period of 4 months. You could quadruple that and still not even be a drop in the bucket of the money you've got left over. Isn't that going to be the argument that Republican leaders are going to be facing for the next...
Sure.
Well, if we're talking, politically speaking, for the next 3 months.
Well, and you can see how it plays out. It'll be a news conference in front of an apartment complex where mom, dad, and the, you know, five kids and the cute puppy are all out on the street now because they weren't able to get any sort of assistance. I mean, this could be played out in district by district across the state because it will be ugly in terms of the human drama, sadly, that unfolds here. You know, this is a bit of an apples to oranges comparison, but if you look at the Federal Reserve, which, again, determines our banking policy and our monetary policy to a large extent, and it has said, basically, in a crisis like this, open the spigots, flood everything with the money now. Okay, we appreciate frugality, we appreciate stewardship of public dollars.
And the debt.
We get it. But if you don't act now, the damage is that you have people who are irrevocably, perhaps, out of, you know, now will be chronically homeless. You have small business owners who aren't just furloughing people, but will be out of business. And in other words, is it better to try to at least
prop people up? It makes it harder to recover in the long term.
The recovery is a fatal. You can't recover from a fatal wound, which
this could be
metaphorically in terms of small businesses and those who are on the brink of eviction or losing their homes is a close to a fatal blow.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, is the state right to wait for more federal guidance before spending the majority of its COVID relief money? A yes or B no. Last week's question, we asked, should the Indiana High School Athletic Association move forward with fall sports? Only 21% of you say yes, 79% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, former Indiana Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, a Republican, says pressure from Donald Trump is the reason Governor Eric Holcomb won't allow many Hoosiers to vote by mail this fall. Mutz and Democratic former Lieutenant Governor Kathy Davis called on Holcomb to expand Indiana's vote by mail, as he did in the primary.
More Hoosiers want the option this year amid concerns about voting in person during the COVID-19 pandemic. Holcomb has steadfastly shot down the idea in recent weeks. He insists polling places will be safe. Mutz says there's no reason to deprive Hoosiers of the choice to vote by mail.
I think the resistance comes from pressure from Washington, D.C. I think these local officials are concerned about what Donald Trump may think about.
Some Indiana counties experienced problems in the primary with mailing ballots out and getting them back in time. Kathy Davis says that's why the decision should be made now.
I don't think we can justify waiting for another 30 days of infection rates to suggest that we really need to provide this option. Fear of voting is suppression of voting.
Analysis from MIT shows that over the last 20 years of mailed-in ballots across the country, there was fraud in just 0.00006% of all votes cast.
Nikki Kelly, what did Governor Holcomb was asked about this this week? What did he have to say?
He was asked a number of times. He's not doing great at articulating his reason. And he says it's not because of fraud.
He's not worried about
and,
fraud.
And he says he's not. It's not because of Trump. And he constantly pivots to the whole we need to be able to vote safe in person, which I don't think anyone's arguing.
Yeah, this isn't an either-or question.
Right. No one's saying all mail. They're just saying there are certain people, due to health risks or whatever, don't feel safe going. And unless you fit into one of those narrow reasons, you would still have to go, and you'd have to make that choice. So I need to understand a little more, because the only thing he's made clear is he doesn't like the fact that we'd have to wait on ballots to be counted, but that, you know, waiting a couple days doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
I'm going to get back to that point in a second, but I'm going to just ask you straight up for a prediction. Are we going to have expanded vote by mail in Indiana this fall?
I think there will be pressure to do so. Other states are moving that direction.
Yeah, we're one of seven.
Yeah, including states, I should point out, that are headed by Republican governors. Whether it's Trump or not, I mean, if it's Trump, I guess I would remind the governor that this is a general election, not a primary, and that he's probably more popular right now in Indiana when you lump the entire electorate, you know, together, not a primary but a general, than the president. So if anything, the president needs Eric Holcomb more than Eric Holcomb needs the president in the general election.
Nikki Kelly just brought up the point. The one thing we did hear from Holcomb as to this is why not to do specifically expanded vote by mail is he said it's election day, not election month. Is that a good enough reason not to expand vote by mail?
Well, it has progressed to election month with early voting and vote centers and things like that. There are more opportunities. I think if to go vote by mail made sense when you had a statewide lockdown and stay-at-home order. It doesn't make sense when you can go sit at a restaurant, but you can't walk into the fairgrounds exposition hall and cast a ballot. So I don't think it should be mandatory.
But it's not an either-or question.
I understand. But fraud's clearly not the reason. I mean, I'm bad with my math, my decimal points on math, but it's kind of like Dumb and Dumber. It's like, so you're saying there's
a chance,
right? I mean, it's 6/1 millionth of a chance of fraud. So that's clearly not the reason. But having as many options as available. And my prediction is we do add to the list of reasons for no excuse mail.
Wouldn't that just be the easiest thing? Say, we're not going to expand vote by mail. We're just going to make one more reason, which is if you're concerned about COVID-19, you get to vote by mail.
That would certainly be a step in the right direction. I think we ought to be doing vote for mail, period. Okay? And the problem isn't. The problem is getting those poll workers who are all older and who are all rightly frightened about contracting the virus to go, and then you get that goofy clerk in Knox County who says he's not even going to require his workers to wear masks. So, yes, there's a legitimate fear here, and what it has to do is the reason he's not giving you a reason is they want fewer people to vote because they think they can identify their voters and bring them out. And from their point of view, the fewer people that vote, the more likely they are to win, and that's all this is about.
I'm not sure. I want to ask you to respond to that, if only because is that the longer that the governor can't articulate a clear reason why not to expand vote by mail, is it easier to accept that Ann's argument is correct, that they just don't want as many people to vote?
I don't know. That's been a Democratic argument for 100 years. I mean, it's
but is there
no
more? But is this? But is there more evidence to suggest that it's true, or is it a more compelling argument this year?
No, I don't think so. I don't think an argument to have a traditional election with an expanded mail-in option or expanding the list of exceptions is a good place to land on this. I think, and my guess would be that's where we're heading.
But I don't think the restaurant argument's going to carry water. Because if you're immunocompromised, you can stay home and be safe.
Someone who wants to go vote, if they're like, I can go everywhere, but I can't go vote.
But you may not be able to vote. You maybe have lines around the block because you're going to have so few polling places.
And there are a lot of people who aren't going out to eat because they are compromised.
So it's a vote.
But there are laws that set ratios on polling places and availability of those. A good problem is having lines wrap around the building.
No, it's not.
I've helped run elections. I've run big campaigns. I've never been a part of one conversation that thought, this is Indiana. We should have fewer people vote.
Not if you're 95 years old.
That's because
everyone go vote. It's a 60% Republican state.
That's because your state chairman doesn't want to articulate that reason.
Well, U.S. Senator Mike Braun says schools need to, quote, take a little risk when it comes to deciding how to reopen this year amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
Braun appeared this week on Fox Business to discuss school reopenings. He lauded Purdue and Notre Dame for their reopening plans, calling them enterprisers who don't, quote, err on the side of taking the bureaucratic approach. Braun says schools need to, in a mitigated way, reopen to in-person instruction, which he calls the most effective way to educate students.
Be safe, take a little risk, address this disease head on, don't hunker down.
Braun says life is about taking a little risk.
John Schwannis, is Mike Braun right?
If I'm a 17-year-old healthy kid, you know, looking forward to playing senior year of athletics, I guess I'm willing to take the risk. If I'm a member of the faculty, perhaps, or a member of the staff, and I'm in an age group that doesn't have that slam dunk certainty of avoiding.
Or is caring for someone in that age group.
Or is caring for someone in that age group. A lot of people who might have asthma, COPD, any number of issues. Clearly, then the calculus changes, and it isn't as easy to make those decisions. So, I don't know, who knows? The National Academy of Sciences, which is generally a pretty well-regarded group, this 2 weeks ago or so, they came out with their recommendation saying that really districts should do everything possible to get kids back in school, especially K through 5 and special needs. They said, you know, if not everybody else,
it's not
working for those kids, and you'll do irreparable damage to the K through 5 kids who never get a basis in the fundamentals. So I guess National Academies know what they're talking about, but it doesn't matter what's going to happen on the opening day, because as we've seen with schools that have already headed back, it's like, whoa, everybody's getting sick. Yeah. Let's rescind our policy.
Well, on this topic, news that broke late yesterday, so we didn't make it into a separate topic for this show, but that I want to talk about now, is that State Senate President Pro Tem Rod Bray sent a letter to school districts saying, warning them that if they do not open to in-person instruction, they will not get the full funding for their students. Now, the background on that conversation is, Indiana law says, Nikki, help us out with what Indiana law
says. It says basically if you provide more than half of your instruction virtually, then you're only eligible for 85% of funding per pupil.
And but legislative leaders and the governor said something about this a couple months ago.
Yes, in June, Governor Holcomb, Chairman Brown for Ways and Means, and Senator Mishler for Appropriations Chair said, hold up, we are going to make sure through a one-year waiver that you guys get 100% funding whether you're there physically or virtually. And then all of a sudden, Bray, just like throwing like a little Molotov cocktail in there, said, basically, like, we might want that, but I mean, the way I read it was, I can't tell if my caucus will actually approve that, so you should plan for 85%.
The governor has stressed that reopening decisions should be made by local leaders at the local level because situations are different in every part of Indiana. Is it really a local decision if you have a gun to your head?
No, and my complaint with him from the beginning is no leadership. If he had masks mandatory with the penalties 6 weeks ago, we wouldn't be facing over 1,000 cases, which is what happened yesterday.
And today.
The risk is going up in Indiana, not down. And you have schools that can do the distancing and the masks and the hand washing. And you have schools that don't have the capability to do that. And they have to go virtual. So, yes, it has to be fixed. It has to be fixed legislatively. The governor can't wave a magic wand and get this done. And it's got to be done in a fashion that the schools are not penalized for something that's totally beyond their control.
Yeah, I mean, Marion County, it's not the schools, it's the health department. I think Elkhart is the same thing. If your positivity rate is at a certain level, they aren't allowing schools to reopen. Should we be penalizing schools for that?
I think what Senator Bray was trying to do was make sure that everyone is working toward in-person education, which I think reflects probably the wishes of most of his caucus. And the reason it's the wishes of most of his caucus is because it's what most people, parents of school-aged children, want first. Unless there is a severe public health reaction to it and a reason not to do it, or schools are completely incapable of it. You're right, the hole in this argument is the school superintendent may not be in charge of opening that school because the county health department may say it's shut down. You know, so should they be penalized in that case? I don't think so, but I think there's a reasonable place to land here, and it feels like that's where we already were kind of coming into this.
Yeah, but it feels like this upset that balance a little bit.
Yeah, I think there are political forces and elected officials that are Mike Brown being one of them, who want a stronger push and a stronger attempt to start in person.
Yeah, I mean,
we talked about the first reason to go.
We talked about Jim Banks having this conversation. We had that conversation a few weeks ago. Jim Banks proposing legislation that would have cut off federal funding from schools that don't reopen.
Yeah.
It feels like the same, not quite the same, but a similar. We're in the similar ballpark.
It's all
here.
To appease Donald Trump. That's what it's all
about. I don't know. I have
school age
kids, and I talk to a lot of parents of school age kids, and none of them are saying, boy, I can't wait till they're sitting at the kitchen table again.
Yeah, I mean, the conversation about reopening is.
But you also don't want to expose them if there's a risk that's substantial.
I'm not sure that people believe they're not being exposed anyway.
And we should point out that Donald Trump's son attends a school, though, that is not starting on time because of COVID.
Well, he also votes by mail.
Well, okay. Right. Not Barron, but
Well, Indiana.
Well, Barron may as well.
Indiana
know.
Schools are reopening for the new academic year with some reporting cases of COVID-19 among staff or students. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay explains, the state's top school official says efforts to find people who have potentially been exposed to the coronavirus is proving difficult.
Indiana has invested millions of dollars in contact tracing to prevent more widespread outbreaks of the coronavirus. But schools are reporting challenges with that process, namely parents who are skeptical of sharing information about their children with strangers over the phone. Indiana Schools Chief Jennifer McCormick says her department has received reports from school leaders that parents aren't responding to contact tracers' phone calls.
The parents usually hang up and call the school and say, I just got a weird call. I'm not sure who it was. I'm not sure if it was legit.
As of Thursday, McCormick says at least 30 school corporations have chosen to start the new year with only virtual instruction.
And Delaney, realistically, how do schools solve this issue?
Until we have a vaccine, they don't.
All right. Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.